signs like this one behind me throughout Spartanburg County, representing TKA. That's Todd Kohlhepp and Associate. Kohlhepp was a fairly well-known real estate agent in the area.
You really never know who the monster is standing next to you. He was a different bird, but he was a good salesman.
Turner says she remembers showing Kohlhepp around her home alone.
He stayed a really long time. He was there probably 2.5 hours. It was very much about him. He was definitely one of those people who liked himself a lot. It's terrifying. And to know that this man's had a key to my home since March.
She can't help but think it could have been her.
He seemed like a normal guy, you know, your typical salesman.
I'm Roberta Shaughnessy, and I hired Todd Kohlhepp to be my realtor. He just seemed like a very outgoing, professional individual at the time when I first met him. Had a great marketing plan. One of the reasons I chose him to be our realtor.
My name is Ron Owen, and Todd Kohlhepp was my next door neighbor, and he lived, our houses were approximately 30 feet from each other. Todd liked to talk about himself. Todd liked to talk about the things that he had. He was consumed with things that he could purchase.
My name is Jennifer Waddell. We decided to purchase a home and started looking on the internet. So we actually called the listing agent, which was Todd Kohlhepp. He was very angry over the phone all the time. I contacted my mortgage officer, and he then proceeded to tell me that this man would go off on tangents for no reason and talk about his guns, his motorcycles, his compound. For no reason, he would just go off on these tangents. My gut instinct about Todd Kohlhepp was that he was a dangerous man. Something inside of me, my gut, made me and pursued me to dig deeper. And so you can look up tax records, property records. I saw his BMWs. I saw his motorcycles. And then his sex offender registry came up. And that's when everything kind of fell into place for me, that this was not a normal situation.
I was watching just the nightly news with my husband and saw the news report about them finding Kayla Brown alive, chained in a storage container. And I'd been aware of the story because she'd been missing for the last 2 months. So I was thinking, oh, how terrible is that? You know, it's just horrible that somebody could do that to this poor girl. And then they showed the picture and I just paused the television and was like, honey, that was our realtor. Oh my goodness.
And I clicked on the link and I knew before the article even came up, it was going to be him. I knew it with all my heart. And when I saw that face, I was just, it sent chills through me and I teared up. It was him. It was him.
It's a double life. And it's, if those other folks feel like I do, it's scary. It's a nightmare to think that this, I don't know if anything was going on the property beside me here, but just to think that this type of activity was going on in Todd's life.
I started thinking about how this man had a key to my home and had access to my home at any given time, whether I was home or not, that he was around my children.
This is True Crime Brewery, and I'm Jill.
Good evening. I'm Dick.
Our episode today is Buried Secrets, The Victims of Todd Kohlhepp. So you might be able to notice I'm really excited about this episode. It's a story that's been all over the news, a successful real estate agent who's been revealed as a serial killer. So there's just a lot of news out there, and I've been learning more every day.
Yeah, this is really almost breaking news.
Yeah, it is. And it's interesting because we're learning a lot about it. So the whole week we've been pretty busy finding out about it. So Todd Kohlhepp was arrested shortly after this missing woman, Kayla Brown, 30 years old, was found chained up in a shark cage that was inside a metal storage container on Todd's property. Kayla had been missing for over 2 months along with her boyfriend, Charles David Carver. Investigators tracked her down after they traced Kayla and Charles' last cell phone pings. And the discovery of Kayla led police to bodies buried on Todd Kohlhepp's property. Since then, he's confessed to multiple murders. So Dick and I have gathered all the latest information on this case, and we'll talk about what we know so far about Todd Kohlhepp's history and his recent confessions. But first, I'm going to read a couple of our 5-star reviews and get the beer opened up.
Ready for the beer. Let's do it.
Okay.
But first,
a couple of 5-star reviews. Okay, so the first one is Awesome Love Jill and Dick by Nahid N. I'm a true crime junkie, so I consider myself somewhat of an expert. Jill and Dick have great chemistry, hence it makes for a great listen. I'm definitely hooked. Keep up the good work, guys. So Nahid N, welcome to the brewery.
Thank you, Nahid.
And the next one is Best Podcast Team by Ron120932. Great podcast. They have awesome podcast voices, good audio. Love the good cop, bad cop explanation of cases. Dick makes me want to try every beer he reviews so beautifully. Keep up the great work. I'll be donating to keep this podcast going.
Well, thank you. That's a great one.
Thanks, Ron, and welcome to the brewery. What's our beer today, Dick?
Well, this is a South Carolina crime.
It is.
It is upstate South Carolina, and I'm picking a beer from the Low Country down by Charleston.
Okay.
It's called Mexican Cake. It's brewed by Westbrook Brewing Company in Mount Pleasant, South Carolina. And they're a fairly new brewery, but already gathering quite a bit of renown. Then Mexican Cake is their Imperial Stout. That is probably their flagship beer. It's the one that I think most... It's a beer that most beer nerds really want to try. So it is an Imperial Stout, and we've talked about these before. If you take your basic stout, the motto for an Imperial Stout is always more is better. So there's more alcohol, more hops, more residual sweetness to an Imperial Stout than there is in a regular stout. Now this particular one, Mexican Cake, is a dark black color with a mocha-colored head, and a little bit of spotty lacing. It's got a cinnamon and chocolate aroma with some vanilla and some spice. The cinnamon comes through quite well in the taste, as well as chocolate cake, vanilla, and a little pepper. It's a thick, creamy beer. There is a little burn from the alcohol. Great beer.
All right. I love it when we have a great beer.
So
why is it called Mexican Cake? Because is there a cake flavor with a chocolate and
yeah,
stuff?
Yeah, kind of a chocolatey cake thing.
Okay.
And you know, when you make chocolate things in Mexico, you usually can add some spices to it. So the cinnamon complements the chocolate quite well.
Okay. Sounds good.
It is.
All right.
World class.
All right. Let's open it up.
Okay.
All right, Dickie, it's time to head on down to the quiet end of the bar for our discussion.
Okay.
Okay.
It looks more quiet tonight. I remember last week there was that couple there that were a little on the sketchy side.
But they were super quiet. They were no problem.
Yeah, I think they were well into their drinks.
Yes. Well, plus didn't you buy them a couple of rounds after?
I did, just because I felt like we were intruding on them, so.
But no worries, because we called them an Uber.
They took the ride home.
Okay. All right, so let's start this discussion because there is a lot to do and it's getting late.
It's a big night.
So let's begin by going over the people we know to be victims of Todd Kohlhepp. Court records of Todd's conviction for the 1986 rape of a 14-year-old girl when he was only 15 reveal him to have been a disturbed adolescent who once threatened to kill his mother. He once used a hammer to destroy his new bedroom set. He poured bleach into a goldfish bowl when he wanted a gerbil, but he got a goldfish, which of course killed the goldfish in a horrible way.
I imagine it would.
He locked a boy in his neighborhood in a dog cage and rolled it around, laughing as the boy cried. And that boy's mother was the one that called him a devil on a chain.
Yeah, that's him.
Yep.
And this was a kid who was getting to be increasingly out of control.
Yes, even his mother says that.
Right. And she ended up shipping him back to his father, or off to his father.
Well, yes, it was when he was with his father that he committed the crime of raping a 14-year-old girl.
But his mother had put up with his behaviors for quite some time before she finally figured she couldn't take care of him anymore.
Yeah, I think she gave it a good try.
Yeah, he was seeing therapists. He had been placed on medications. I don't know exactly which ones, but
yeah,
he had meds. He was in therapy.
Yep.
Nothing was working.
Now, he pled guilty to that crime in a plea bargain to kidnapping, and he was sentenced to 15 years in prison. He'd originally been charged with sexual assault and kidnapping. According to the policewoman on the scene in 1986, she responded to a young boy in Todd's neighborhood who was frantic because he couldn't find his 14-year-old sister. So while she was talking to the boy at the home, trying to find out where the girl was, the victim walked in through her back door of her home, and she said that she needed to talk to the policewoman. So she told the policewoman that Todd had come to her front door and lured her outside. Once he got her out into the alley, he put a gun to her head, and he walked her over to his house where he lived with his father. Now, the thing about this is he actually pulled the trigger on the way, which would have killed her, but the gun misfired. So that's shocking.
Shocking, and good fortune for the young lady, huh?
Yeah. Now, Todd's father was away, and he took the girl to his room. He taped her mouth with duct tape, and he tied her hands with rope. Now, he placed a knife next to her, and he raped her in his room. The policewoman went to Todd's house after the girl had come home, and he answered the door with a rifle in his hand.
Whoa.
Yeah. So what he did was he asked her what was going to happen to him and how much time he was going to get, and then he did surrender. And fortunately, she did have backup with her at that point. So psychological evaluations from this time portray him as an emotionally disturbed 15-year-old. I mean, that's no surprise.
Yeah, that's a bit of an understatement,
yeah.
Right?
With explosive anger issues, minimal family support, and little remorse for his crime.
Right.
Now, when he was questioned about the crime, he told a probation officer that he wasn't sure why he had raped the girl, but it could have been an act of rebellion, he said, because his father was away. When asked how he thinks the rape had affected the victim, Todd said, "I've messed myself up, too." So he told the officer that he knew it was wrong, but he thought the girl was 16, so he seemed to think that made it less wrong.
That makes a big difference, doesn't it?
Sure.
Gosh.
Now, because of this, he thought a 15-year sentence was unfair to him, and he wanted a 12-year sentence because he was thinking he wanted to be able to join the military when he got out. Now, I don't think you can do that if you're a felon.
Yeah, I don't know whether it's 12 years or 15 years, he would still be allowed to join the military.
Right. Well, this is what he thought at that age.
Yeah.
So the 14-year-old victim's parents had told investigators that the rape had a devastating effect on their whole family. The girl cried and she was unable to communicate during her interview, and her parents said her grades and athletic participation had deteriorated. They said that Todd was a violent and vicious person, and that he'd shine the knife in the girl's face as he was sexually assaulting her.
Yeah, I can only imagine the terror that that poor girl felt.
Yeah. So she was his first actual victim. Although you could probably say there were other victims of his outbursts.
Yeah, I mean, the kitty put in the cage and rolled around.
Right, right. But I guess she would be his first, well, I hate to say serious, but, you know, that's a lot more serious, really.
Yeah,
so this was his first really serious violent crime that we know of.
Okay, so he serves his 14, 15 years. He served 14 of the 15, correct?
I think so. Now, on November 6th of 2003, Scott Ponder, Ponder's mother, Beverly Guy, Brian Lucas, and Chris Sherbert were all found fatally shot in a motorsports shop in Chesney, South Carolina. Superbikes Motorsports was a high-performance motorcycle shop that was owned by Scott Ponder. So Scott Ponder's friend, Noel Lee, spoke to him before he drove to the shop on this morning, November 6, 2003. And 7 minutes later, when he arrived at the shop, four people were lying there murdered in pools of blood, and he was the one that called 911. So mechanic Chris Sherbert's body was found in the back of the shop. He was bent over as if he'd been in the middle of working on a bike, and Beverly, Scott's mom, was also in the back. It appeared that she was ambushed just as she was stepping out of the restroom. The bodies of Brian Lucas and Scott Ponder were in the front of the store. So Scott's wife, Melissa, was 7 weeks pregnant at this time, and he didn't seem to have any enemies when investigators started to look around and figure out what the heck happened. So mechanic Chris Sherbert was due in court the following Monday, so they kind of looked at him to see if there was any kind of connection. There were some rumors of a possible drug connection, and maybe it was a drug-related murder with Chris as the target.
Sure. They don't have much in the way of leads or anything.
No.
So they're kind of expanding the net, seeing what they can find.
Right. But actually, that theory was pretty quickly eliminated. They got through that pretty quickly. So they've got this mass murder of 4 people. They don't know how or why it happened. So, of course, they're going to look at the lives of all these 4 victims.
Right.
Yeah.
And they had some other leads. Mm-hmm. They did get a sketch that was released to the public and was based on a witness who saw a tall man in a leather coat at the shop just a few minutes before the shooting.
Mm-hmm.
But that went nowhere. Then Scott's wife, Melissa, gave birth to a son. Police did a DNA test on a diaper they'd taken from the trash, and they contacted Melissa and told her that Scott wasn't the baby's father based on the DNA testing. So Melissa was very upset.
Well, yeah, I think their theory here was that there was some kind of love triangle.
Right, and
yeah,
that she had a hand to or actually did the killings.
Yeah, yeah.
So she demanded a second DNA test, but the results were the same. The test confirmed that the father of Melissa's child was actually Brian Lucas, the man whose body was found just a few feet away from Scott's. But she was adamant that the police had it all wrong. And this is just a horrific comedy of errors, because they mislabeled the DNA.
Well, Melissa said to them, "We worked hard for that baby. We had to have medical procedures to get pregnant, and I know he's the father." So she insisted that she was getting an attorney, and she wanted Scott's body to be exhumed and have the DNA testing redone. So they'd done the diaper DNA test, and then she demanded that they do another one when she brings the baby in.
Right.
They do it again.
And that's the swab of the cheek.
Right.
That also matched up with the friend.
Right. So they're both showing that it's not Scott's baby.
Right.
But she knows that this wasn't like a natural pregnancy. They had medical procedures. They wanted to have a baby. So she insists that they're going to exhume Scott's body and get the DNA testing redone. But fortunately, the exhumation didn't happen. It took 18 months for her to be proved right, though. Investigators compared Scott's DNA to his mother's DNA, which had also been gathered at the scene because his mother was one of the victims, Beverly. And those two didn't match. So that's when they figured out that they'd incorrectly labeled Brian as Beverly's son. But Scott was her son, actually. So the blood had been mislabeled, and that had happened, they think, when Scott and Brian's bodies were examined because they were laying just feet away from each other out front.
Yeah, but still.
Well, that's no excuse.
No.
It's pretty shoddy work. But at the time of the Superbike Motorsports murders, Todd Kohlhepp had been out of prison for about 2 years. And according to his confession, he traveled to the shop and spoke with Scott Ponder and another employee. He wanted to learn how to ride a motorcycle, and apparently they'd laughed at him when he fell over on a bike. So, Regina Kohlhepp, well, I think she has a different last name, actually, but Regina, Todd's mother, said that Todd was bullied and embarrassed, and I think he just held it in long enough. You know, this is why people tell kids not to bully. This is what can happen. So
well, not to that extent.
Well, no, and I think this...
So he got ridiculed and bullied, and he shot and killed 4 people.
Well, this lady is going through some denial and working this through in her mind, right? Because she's just found out that her son did these horrible things.
I can see that. I mean, although I still think she's a bit of an apologist for him.
Well, sure, but she's a mother, so I'm not going to hold it against her, really. But you're right. I mean, it's ridiculous to think that bullying would lead to this with any normal person.
Exactly.
This is so extreme. Now, Melissa Brackman, the widow of the shop owner, Scott Ponder, has a different version of what happened anyway. So she said that, "I was told he was a disgruntled customer," she said. He bought a motorcycle from Scott previously, and it was stolen. So he went to the shop to get another one. So she said, my husband and the service manager were poking fun at him, saying, hey, is the second motorcycle going to get stolen too? And didn't you have enough already? And she says they were just kidding, but it really made him angry. So she was interviewed on HLN, and this is what she had heard from her husband about what had happened. Because her husband did tell her that they had been joking with this guy. It wasn't on the same day.
But they hadn't identified him as Cole Hepp. They just
said this guy at the shop.
Can you believe this guy
came
in and this is what we were kind of ragging on him a little bit.
Right.
No big deal.
They didn't think it was a big deal. But apparently it was to Cole Hepp.
Yes.
So Melissa said that she thinks the investigation and Cole Hepp's confession is just the beginning. She thinks he's been wreaking havoc all over the place for years, wherever he's been. She thinks that there's probably a lot more to what he's done than what we know of at this point, which could be accurate.
Yeah, I think we'll talk about that later when discussing what the profiler says.
Right.
But we know that while he was in prison, there weren't any murders.
Well, right. There were murders, I'm sure.
By him.
Well, you couldn't have murders by him if he's in prison.
Yeah. So he's been out a couple years.
Yeah.
Before the killings.
Right.
And then, and you'll go into this more, but then there was like 12 years between the quadruple killings and the motorcycle shop and
the next murders.
When the lady and her boyfriend went missing.
Sure.
And as it turns out, there's another couple that were murdered before that. So, but you still have several years where there's no apparent victims, and you got to think that he wasn't laying low, that he was probably killing people.
Well, we don't know. There could be, yeah.
But according to the people that know serial killers and their psychological bent,
yeah,
it's extremely unlikely that he wasn't continuing to kill people.
But since his 2001 release to the time of these killings, he had accomplished a lot. Now, he'd earned a bachelor's degree in computer science while he was in prison. And from January 2002 to November 2003, he actually worked as a graphic designer for a company in Spartanburg. Now, he began studying at Greenville Technical College in 2003, and then he transferred to the University of South Carolina, upstate, in 2004. And in 2008, he graduated with a bachelor's degree in business administration and marketing. So, despite being a registered sex offender, Todd was able to get his real estate license, and that he did on June 30th of 2006. So, what do we know about getting your real estate license? Can you do that as a felon, or did he lie in his application?
Well, the stuff I read about how to get a realtor's license in South Carolina.
Yeah.
No mention at all of whether a felony would disqualify you.
That surprises me.
Basically, if you're 21 years old, have a high school diploma, complete a 60-hour course, and pass an exam, you're a licensed real estate agent.
Okay.
In South Carolina. And then you can become a real estate broker once you've worked for at least 3 years as a licensed real estate agent. And do an additional 150 hours of coursework.
So he must have done that as well.
So he was a broker.
Yeah.
Because he had his own company.
Well, yeah, he built a firm that had 12 agents working for him.
Yeah.
At the time of his arrest.
But there was no mention at all whether a felony conviction would disqualify you from becoming a real estate agent.
Well, I have to say that surprises me, because then you have a key to people's homes. And if he's a registered sex offender, don't you think he had to be around children when he's showing some homes?
He quite possibly could be.
Yeah, so that I don't know. But you couldn't see any reason why he wouldn't have been able to do it.
None at all.
Okay. Well, one customer of Cole Hepp's remembered him as being extremely outgoing and professional, but also noted that he would talk a lot about his firearms, and he put a lot of sexual innuendo into their conversations. This was a woman. Now, a banker who had worked with Cole Hepp said he would often watch pornography, even at work, on his work computer, like when people were coming and going in the office. So that's definitely strange.
Yeah. At work?
Yeah.
While the office is open?
Yeah.
Just sitting there looking at porn?
Yep.
Woo.
Yeah. and another colleague described him as very angry and condescending.
Okay. That would sound more like it, although the first one you mentioned thought he was a pretty gregarious guy.
Yeah. I think to be a salesman, you have to be gregarious.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But he didn't make any mention of being underlying angry.
Not that one guy, but other people had.
Other people did.
So there are varying opinions.
So, yeah.
Now, Johnny Joe Coxie, who was 29, and his wife Megan Lee McCraw Coxie, who was 26, they were a little bit of drifters. They were from Spartanburg, and they were reported missing on December 22, 2015. Now, they were allegedly hired by Kohlhepp to work on his property. And their bodies were discovered on Kohlhepp's property earlier this month after they found the girl that was being held captive. Now, Johnny had been killed by a gunshot wound to the torso, and Megan had been killed by a gunshot wound to her head. A former co-worker of Megan Coxie has told authorities that Megan met Todd Kohlhepp while working at a Waffle House restaurant. Now, she said Kohlhepp frequented the Waffle House in Roebuck, South Carolina. And Kohlhepp would allegedly invite the waitresses to his home while leaving large tips for his meals. And then he kind of became known as a creeper to the women who worked there. A cook from the restaurant has said that Kohlhepp's behavior was so disturbing that in 2015 he began to take Kohlhepp's orders instead of the waitresses because the waitresses didn't want to go near his tables. Now, Megan and Johnny had lived kind of a rough life, quite probably related to some drug addiction. They were both released from jail early in December 2015, just weeks before they went missing. So the couple had a history of panhandling, and Megan had been charged with child neglect after their newborn had tested positive for heroin. So the couple's baby was placed in the custody of family members. So it's easy to judge this couple, I guess, you know. They were exposing an infant to heroin, and that's terrible. But I just want to say we should remember that these two people have the potential to improve their lives and change for the better, and that potential was absolutely stolen by Todd Kohlhepp in a violent and horrible way.
Absolutely. But these would be the type of people that Kohlhepp would prey on.
That's the thing, yeah. You know? Right. Because he would think that people aren't going to be looking for them as much because they're not maybe as dependable in life.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So he allegedly murdered them in cold blood. But the thing is, could his behavior have been predicted? Could seeing the way he lived his life up to that point predict the life of a serial killer? And a lot of people think that it could. So as he built a successful real estate firm, his behavior often struck people as really odd. He was known to watch the pornographic films at work, like I said. He would make lots of inappropriate jokes, even in his marketing literature. And he would openly discuss that he was a sex offender, which was weird. But, you know, he was also an award-winning real estate agent, and he was described as a hard worker. And many people thought he was a pretty good boss overall.
Right. But at the same time, I think some of his, you know, talking about being a sex offender, he was minimizing it and saying it was more statutory rape than anything else.
Oh.
So he didn't tell the whole story.
Sure. Well, I wouldn't think that he would.
So, you know, makes it sound more consensual sex.
Yeah. Do we know what he said? Or
just that he thought she was 16 and it was consensual and her father was really upset.
Yeah, I think what I'd read was that he claimed that they were trumped-up charges that he'd gotten when he went on a joyride with another teenager.
Yeah,
whose right. father got mad about it, yeah. So that sounds about right.
So we've got this guy who's got kind of a checkered past, right?
Sure, I'd say more than checkered.
Right.
Maybe striped.
And we've got some of his co-workers just think he's a piece of crap. The Waffle House that he frequented, waitresses didn't want to go near him.
Yeah, yeah.
There's probably good reason for that. A mortgage banker who worked with Kohlhepp, named Lawrence Shorts, told investigators that Todd Kohlhepp was a type AA, hair-on-fire kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
So what's that mean?
hair on fire. That's somebody who's like always like right on the edge, running around, you know, getting things done. Not a person who would sit back and think things over.
Yeah, I guess Schwartz also said he made ominous comments about having trouble sleeping and how he would know where people live.
Yuck. Yeah, he did say a lot of weird things like that. I read from a lot of people. Talk about his guns, talk about getting up at night and doing things, just weird stuff.
He would brag about chasing people off his rural property. He had this property, that's where they found the young lady.
Yeah, it was almost 100 acres, I think, 93 acres.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
So he used to chase people off of that with an arsenal of guns. And not just guns, but they had silencers and night vision equipment.
Huh.
So you might ask, how do you amass all these guns?
Well, if you're a felon and a sex offender, how do you amass all these
guns?
You
aren't going to get them.
Well, how did he get them, though? He did get them. So I'm sure there are some loopholes.
Well, I mean, the most obvious is that he bought them on the black market. But the more easy way is to go to a gun show, because there's no rules that regulate the sale of private firearms at a gun show in South Carolina, like a bunch of other states. So you can go to a gun show, chat up somebody who's got guns that you want, and you can buy them, and there's no questions asked.
Well, that doesn't make any sense to me. If you can't legally buy guns, why would you be able to do that?
Doesn't make any sense to me either.
I mean, we could quite logically say that these people may not have been killed if he had not accessed guns.
No.
I mean, he may have found another way, but this certainly made it easier for him.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll grant that.
Yeah.
He would have killed him anyway, because that's how his mind works.
I guess, but I think if he had a knife, that people may have been able to fight a little bit more.
Well, possibly.
I think a gun makes it pretty easy to kill someone. So these, the motorsports murders, they were unsolved for 13 years. So the victims were Scott Ponder, and he was the one with the pregnant wife that owned the place, and his mother, Beverly. And then we also had Brian Lucas. So Brian Lucas, he was actually a quarterback when he was 11 or 12. And an interesting story that his family told was that he got tackled and bent backward, almost like a stapler, his father said, when he was on the field. And he had to be taken to the emergency room. So doctors said that he was lucky to be so flexible, or he might have had some spinal damage. And after that, Brian was really skittish about playing football. And that's when he turned to dirt bikes and motorcycles, and that was his love, working on bikes and riding bikes and going fast on them.
Okay. And that doesn't sound like it's a safer avocation.
Well, maybe he saw it that way.
Yeah.
But his mom, Lorraine, she said that she couldn't watch him race. It just made her really nervous. But he was a guy who loved speed and loved bikes, so I just wanted to say a little something about him. And then Chris Sherbert, who was another guy that was killed at the motorbikes, he lived for motorcycles, according to his family. They said he died in a motorcycle shop and was buried with grease under his fingernails. He was doing what he loved and what he was best at, said his half-brother. He was so devoted to fixing things, and he always had dirty hands, and his family decided to bury him with the grease still under his nails as well. Now, Scott Ponder and Brian Lucas, who ran the shop together, took Sherbert under their wing, said Tom Lucas, Brian Lucas's father. They all shared this love of motorcycles and speed, and they were all doing what they loved when they died. So that kind of gives them some comfort.
Small comfort.
Yeah. So this Johnny and Megan Coxey, who disappeared December 2015, family and friends had a memorial service for them just this past Sunday. And about 100 people gathered in Spartanburg. They'd been missing for almost a year, December 15th, 2015. So Johnny's aunt Tara and Megan's father spoke at the service. A teddy bear that Megan had played with as a child and some of Johnny's sports trophies were displayed at the service. And they were both described as really fun, free-spirited young people who positively influenced other people's lives. So, like I said, these motorsports murders went unsolved for 13 years, And when Kohlhepp was arrested this month, the sheriff said that he confessed to the bike shop shootings, and he pointed investigators to three shallow graves on his land as well. An agent at Kohlhepp's firm, Cherry Lawrence, told the New York Times that she met Todd Kohlhepp a decade ago. They were actually study partners at USC Upstate. She was really surprised by these accusations. She thought that these crimes were very much out of his character, so she didn't see him as a disturbed individual at all.
Obviously not.
Now, Shorts, the banker who worked with Kohlhepp, says that Kohlhepp appeared to be successful. He drove expensive cars, he owned property, he also had his private pilot's license. So I guess that's something you can get as a felon as well?
It certainly is. The only thing that would disqualify you from a pilot license is a conviction, drug-related or alcohol-related.
Whoa. Okay, so...
I know.
Let's talk about that, because that means if he'd gotten a DUI years ago, he wouldn't be able to get a pilot's license. But he raped someone, and he could get a pilot's license.
I know. Truth is stranger than fiction, right?
That's just crazy.
It is. Well, it's just crazy to me. And before I get all the gun advocates after me, but it's just crazy to me that you can go to a gun show and buy a gun with no questions asked as a private sale.
I agree.
That's just mind-boggling.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we're not gun people, but even a gun person, I would hope, would not want someone like him to have guns. And he seemed to have an arsenal of guns.
They found a whole cache of guns in his home. So I guess... he's arrested or at least brought in for questioning because the woman who was found on his property. And he pretty quickly confesses to holding her prisoner, killing her boyfriend, killing two other people.
Mm-hmm.
And then he confesses to the bike shop murders.
Okay.
So what's this, like he's unburdening himself?
I don't know. Now, surprisingly, his sex offender status was common knowledge. He claimed that the charges were trumped up, like we said, after a joyride, but no one seemed to really question that. That was just kind of an accepted thing. Now, Kayla Brown, this was the next victim, and Charlie Carver, her boyfriend, they met at Kayla's mom's work. Now, she was 30, outgoing and very caring. Charles was Joanne Shifflin's firstborn son. Now, he had a younger sister who he loved very much, and at 32 years old, he was working as an operator of a printer at a local business. Now, his father Chuck told the 48 Hours crew that Charlie was a gentle soul who would give you his last $2 or the shirt off his back if that's what you needed. So Charlie had been separated from his wife Nikki recently, and he'd moved in with Kayla Brown, his girlfriend. It was kind of a complicated thing, though family and close friends thought that they were going to make a go of it. The two seemed to really be in love. Now, the couple went missing near Spartanburg, South Carolina, on August 31st of this year. And days after they went missing, a friend noticed that someone was leaving some cryptic Facebook messages on their pages belonging to Kayla and Charlie. And the messages indicated that the couple were just fine, married, buying a new house. So, just really weird stuff. But Kayla knew Todd Kohlhepp. She'd done some cleaning for his real estate business, and Charlie had gone with her to the secluded property that day that they went missing. So his Facebook page has been taken off the, I almost want to say off the air, but it's off Facebook now.
Kohlhepp's.
Kohlhepp's, yeah. Yep. But he did have some things on his page and also some things they thought that they might have put on Charlie's. I know you have some info on that. Why don't you share that with us?
Yeah, it's kind of chilling.
Yeah.
I think. So the Kayla Brown and Charlie Carver went missing on August 31st. And on October 1st, somebody posted on Charlie's Facebook account the final lines of the Eagles song, Hotel California. Huh? Last thing I remember, I was
creepy.
Running for the door. I had to find the passage back to the place I was before. Relax, said the nightman. We are programmed to receive. You can check out any time you like, but you can never leave.
I always found that song scary when I was a kid. It's a scary song.
It is. He's also believed to have posted some stuff on an Amazon.com review of some master padlocks.
There were a couple of those Amazon reviews, yeah.
Yeah. Now my locks have locks. Place is Hotel California now. This was in January of 2015. So before these other people went missing.
That's
then
good.
For a shovel with a folder handle, he posted...
Folding.
A folding handle.
Yeah.
He posted a review suggesting you can keep it in your car for when you have to hide the bodies and you left your full-size shovel at home. And then for a knife review, he wrote, I haven't stabbed anyone yet, but I'm keeping the dream alive, and when I do, it will be with a quality tool like this.
Now, we should say it isn't proven that he wrote those, but...
He's believed to have
written those. He is believed to have written those reviews, yeah.
Yeah. And there's some other stuff, too, but I'll...
Yeah.
I'll leave that. Although there's...
Well, what about the stuff that they think he might have put on Charlie's page? Do you have that?
Well, I have just some postings on the account and then the line from the Eagles song.
Oh, okay.
I don't have anything else. Do you?
Yes, I think so. On September 15th, 2 weeks after Kayla Brown and Charlie Carver went missing, Cole Hepp posted, reading the news, this person...
We think Cole Hepp posted.
Yes, we think it was him. There's reason to believe it was him.
All right.
Actually, this one, it was him, because these are things that he did post.
These are on his own
Facebook
page.
On his account. Yes, on September 15th, 2 weeks after Kayla Brown and Charlie Carver went missing, Cole Hepp posted on his own Facebook account. Okay?
Okay.
Reading the news.
You confused me for a minute there.
I did.
Because I thought we were talking about Charlie Carver's Facebook account.
Sure, I know what you're saying. I gotcha.
Okay.
But this is what he posted on his own account. So he posted, reading the news, this person missing, that person missing, another person missing. Oh, wait, that person just went to the beach with a friend. Other person found with her parole violation boyfriend. In the event I become missing, please note no one would take me.
Huh.
So, like you said, Cole Hepp's Facebook page was closed on November 8th. But a local resident showed the DailyMail.com an eerie picture that Cole Hepp had posted on his Facebook. And the image shows a woman walking through Cole Hepp's 96-acre property in Woodruff, South Carolina. It seems that she was photographed without her knowledge. The woman's wearing a purple dress, she has long blonde hair, and she's walking away from or past Cole Hepp, whose land was open to the public access until he had installed a wire fence around the entire perimeter. So I thought that was pretty creepy, too.
It is. And I know the police are investigating... for the possibility of other bodies or other murders.
Right.
And
yeah,
I guess one of the obvious things would be to look for any reports of missing people.
Well, they are looking into that. They're looking in Arizona as well as South Carolina for any kind of missing people, any murders.
Right.
To anything they can connect with him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the police have said they're not in any hurry. They can take their time now because he's in... police custody, and he's not getting any kind of bond, so he'll be there.
Yeah, he's not going to get released.
Right.
And the trial will take however long it takes to come.
Right. Yeah.
So they'll still be talking to him and see if he's got any more things to tell them.
Oh, I'm sure, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
The last thing I heard was that he wants to represent himself in court, so that should be interesting.
Yeah.
He had a public defender, but he wasn't happy with him. So that'll be interesting. So back to Kayla and Charlie. They were reported missing after friends and family stopped hearing from them. And their shared home was found unlocked, and their dog was abandoned and unfed in the home. Charlie's car was still in the parking lot of their apartment complex, though. And then on November 3rd, Kayla was found in a 30-foot-long, 15-foot-wide metal storage container on Todd Colehep's Woodruff, South Carolina property. So she was chained to this big shark cage within the container. And there was some kind of chain coming from the top of the cage down to something around her neck. And Kayla has told police that Colehep fed her once a day, and he did occasionally take her outside of the container into the light and the fresh air, but that he'd also taken her out to where these graves were of the people he'd killed previously to threaten her. So Kayla told police that she'd witnessed Cole Hepp kill Charlie Carver. And then they did find Charlie's body. So Charlie's body was found on the property, and he had been shot to death. So Kayla said that Culhap had dragged her to the three graves on his property, and that he told her if she tried to escape, she would end up going into one of those graves. And a lot of weapons and ammunition were found on the property as well. Authorities confiscated assault rifles and handguns. And we don't know how he got them, as you said, because South Carolina law prohibits violent felons from owning firearms.
Yeah, not just South Carolina law, every state.
Is it every single state?
Sure.
Probably, yeah.
If you are convicted of a felony, you're not going to be a gun owner.
Well, that makes sense, but obviously it's not working.
There's plenty of loopholes.
Yeah. So according to a neighbor, Culhap bought that property in 2014, and to keep people out, he'd installed some deer cameras, some bear traps, and a chain link fence along the whole perimeter. So that's a huge fence.
Wow, gosh, I guess.
Yeah.
Almost 100 acres of land?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So Kayla was rescued when they heard her banging in the container. So I've heard various reports. I've heard that they arrived on the property with a search warrant because of an anonymous tip. And then what was the other reason we heard that they arrived? Oh, because of the cell phone pings.
Yes.
So maybe it was a combination of the two. I'm not sure.
Yeah, because, I mean, they wouldn't have been out there just passing through. I mean, there was a reason for being there.
Yeah.
They were ready to search the property.
Yeah, I just didn't know if it was one of those reasons or both. I'm not sure.
They heard, well, the cell phone stuff is pretty compelling.
Yeah.
I don't know.
About the anonymous tip thing.
The anonymous tip thing, I would think that if somebody had knowledge of a woman being held prisoner there, they would have gone to the police as soon as they heard that.
Yeah, yeah. But maybe they hadn't heard it right away.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe someone heard the noise. We don't know, but the cell phone thing does seem to make sense to me.
It does.
So he was arrested at his home, so not at that property, but at his home, after Kayla Brown was discovered. And then he later confessed to the motorsports murders and the murders of Johnny and Megan. And Johnny and Megan's bodies were found on the property as well. So they'd been buried for about 11 months.
Right.
A lot of stuff coming out still all the time.
Yeah, and there's this... still going to be more, I'm sure.
Right.
He has been charged with the murders of Scott Ponder, Beverly Ponder, Chris Sherbert, and Brian Lucas at the motorsports shop. He's also been charged on one count of kidnapping in relation to Kayla Brown's abduction. There's the expectation that he's going to be charged in the murders of Johnny and Megan Coxey and Charles Carver. He's also confessed to the murder of a man in Arizona.
Yeah, and we don't know who that was or what the circumstances were about that one.
Wow. That's a shot in the dark here. He's confessed to doing that. Well, you had mentioned that they were going to be looking at unsolved murders in Arizona.
Yeah.
So this might be one of those.
Sure. So experts actually say that it's not uncommon for serial killers to go undetected. You know, if they blend well into their communities and if they take breaks from their murdering... that lasts months or years, they might not get found out for a long time. And actually, what's interesting is that these cooling off periods used to be part of the definition of serial killers. And that was used to distinguish them from mass murderers. Now, the FBI defines a mass murderer as the murder of at least four people in a single incident. So his killing at the motorbikes was a mass murder.
That didn't have to be a serial killer murder.
Didn't have to be, but
except for the fact that he's killed other people.
Right, because a serial killer are those who kill at least two people in separate incidents. So he would actually meet both of those criteria.
Right.
So experts also say that it's very unusual for a serial killer to begin with the mass murder, which is what he did.
Well, if he's confessed to killing a guy in Arizona... He started before the killings of four people in the shop.
Well, possibly. We don't know if he could have visited somewhere in between and done that. We don't know.
Right.
But I see what you're saying. It's a good point.
Yeah.
Could have happened beforehand.
Well, he says it did.
He said it happened beforehand?
Culhap.
He did say when? I didn't hear anything about when.
He killed someone in Arizona.
Yes, but he didn't say when.
Oh, my assumption was that's when he was living there.
Well, I understand. I think that's an appropriate assumption to a point, but we don't know that. He could have visited Arizona a year ago, killed somebody.
True.
So we don't know.
Okay.
So also according to the FBI, many serial killers appear so normal that they don't raise any suspicions. So this is probably a mixture of diligence, a carefully constructed facade, and the type of victims they selected, as you mentioned earlier. Selecting victims that might not be missed as easily and might not be detected as soon.
Yeah, I think the couple that had trouble with the law would qualify for that. But the motorbike people, with the exception of one guy who might have had some minor brush with the law, these were upstanding citizens.
Sure.
They had a successful business.
Well, that was a totally different kind of situation because that was going in and doing a mass shooting. Nobody was hidden or buried.
Right.
So that was totally different. So Dr. Helen Morrison, an expert on serial killers, who said that she's interviewed 115 of them, has said that serial killers often go undetected because of their apparent normalcy. In fact, she said, most people who know the serial killer are shocked when he's finally arrested because he seems so nice and so normal. So at a 5-day symposium on serial killers that was hosted by the FBI in 2005, there were 135 experts, and they determined that the majority of serial killers are not reclusive social misfits, which is what a lot of people think.
Yeah.
And they usually hide in plain sight in their communities.
They're good citizens for all appearances.
Yeah, a lot of them are, I guess. So there's really no single profile that fits all serial killers. But they did mention some common traits I thought we could talk about. So, of course, there are myths out there, such as the popular misconception that they are highly intelligent white males motivated by sex, which you see a lot in the movies. Right? You see a lot of that guy.
Yeah, but that's
like American Psycho.
Dramatization.
Yeah.
It's to get people to go to the movie and stuff.
Okay.
To sell tickets. You're going to tell us that that's not always the case.
No, that's a myth. She said that's a myth. So she said that the majority are males, of course, which I don't think that surprises any of us.
No, we'll buy that.
Yeah. But about half of them are African American men.
Right.
Which surprised me.
And they're not geniuses.
No, nope, they're not all geniuses.
They're not super intelligent.
Nope.
Because I guess you have to, the myth would say that because they get away with it for some time. So they must be really smart to do that.
Well, this Todd Kohlhepp seemed pretty smart. He had some degrees. He seemed like a pretty smart guy.
Well, he's smart enough, yeah.
Yeah, smarter than average. Many don't have an advanced education or a criminal record as an adult, but they often do have brushes with the law when they're juveniles, which would also apply to him. So they often
he had plenty of scrapes.
Yes, he did. He had quite a few red flags, yeah. Probably more than most.
And maybe they weren't criminal actions, but they certainly were things that raised red flags.
Well, they were antisocial for sure.
Absolutely. And then culminating in the kidnapping and rape of the 14-year-old.
Which is quite shocking for a 15-year-old to do something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know how rare that is, but that sounds pretty rare. Pretty extreme.
It does.
For someone that age.
For only age 15.
Yeah. That's pretty bad. Now, serial killers often live a middle-class lifestyle, she said. And they have a few close friends, but are not usually recluses like a lot of people might think. But one thing that they all have in common is that they're expert manipulators. Very manipulative. But there's no single thing that motivates all serial killers. And about half of all serial killers are sexual predators. One common trait of serial killers is a lack of remorse. They feel little empathy for others. As a group, serial killers suffer from a variety of personality disorders, including psychopathy, antisocial personality, and borderline personality disorders, among other things.
Exactly.
But interestingly enough, most are not adjudicated as insane under the law.
Sure.
Because I think for that, you have to not know right from wrong. Is that what the...
That's one thing, yeah.
Or is that just something I heard on TV?
No.
I'm not sure.
I mean...
To be insane, though, it seems like there's a high threshold to prove insanity. in court.
Well, yeah, because you read about insanity pleas. They never work, right?
Right, very rarely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why do you think that is?
Because they usually end up being able to show that the person knew right from wrong.
Yeah.
And therefore they couldn't be.
So they weren't insane because they knew what reality was, knew what they were doing, something like that. Yeah. Well, I just find that fascinating.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
So when Kohlhepp was an adolescent, he was diagnosed with some antisocial personality traits, but no mental illness.
Okay.
And as you mentioned, he showed no remorse or sympathy for the 14-year-old that he kidnapped and raped.
No, in his interview about that, from what I read, he was saying, well, sure, you know, it messed her up, but it messed me up, too. And by the way, you know, anyway, I thought she was 16, so it seemed like he was trying to minimize it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just like he did as a man when he was talking about it, he was minimizing it. And I don't know if that's how he personally coped with it, or if that was just something he said to other people to cover for himself. It almost seems like he was believing that to a certain extent. You know, in my opinion.
Yeah. No, yeah. I think that's a valid opinion.
You think so?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So here's another myth. Serial killers want to be caught.
Yeah. Now, that's definitely a myth you see in movies and TV shows.
Right.
And I never believed that.
No.
And,
no. And the studies suggest otherwise. Most serial killers plan their offenses, but the logistics of committing murders and disposing of the bodies obviously can be quite complex.
Sure.
Right?
Yes, especially nowadays with CSI and forensics.
Yeah.
It's not like the Old West.
There's cameras all over the place.
That's another thing. There are cameras everywhere.
Cell phone towers.
Cell phone pings, yeah.
So it's more complex. And
they
need to target, approach, control, and dispose of their victims. So I think what they've shown is that early successes make them feel empowered, which can make them feel like they can't get caught. And then they start making mistakes. So most of the FBI experts, or most of the experts, say that serial killers at some point become convinced that they're pretty invincible and that they begin to take shortcuts and take more chances. So that's not specifically wanting to be caught. They just feel like they can't be caught.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. So in the case of Todd Kohlhepp, from what we know so far, he seemed to be motivated by rage, anger, rage. That seemed to be the big focus here, although he definitely had the sexual predator to it as well. His emotional and behavioral problems manifested when he was only 15 months old, actually. And in preschool, he was known to destroy other children's projects, to hit them and bite them. As I mentioned earlier in this episode, he had bleached a goldfish to death because he wanted a gerbil. He had actually shot a dog with a BB gun also in his childhood, and he was kicked out of the Boy Scouts for his behavior. So as a pre-adolescent, he spent 3.5 months in a mental hospital because he couldn't control his anger and he was acting out in school. And during psychological evaluations in his teens, Kohlhepp said that his favorite hobby was collecting weapons, something his biological father did. So he'd actually used his father's gun in the kidnapping and rape of the 14-year-old neighbor. But, you know, he didn't really take responsibility because he was blaming his crime. He blamed his anger at his father's absence from the home for making him act out and commit this crime against the girl.
Right.
So he was really good at deflecting
blame. Oh,
definitely. Yeah.
So there's a Dr. Catherine Russland who's works for Psychology Today, and she studied Todd Kohlhepp, and she's defined him as a probable anger-motivated serial killer, which you had mentioned before. These killers believe they're defending themselves against those who have wronged them. Aggression seems to preserve their sense of safety. So they have a deep insecurity in childhood with parents who fight or split up or treat their children as burdens or abuse them. So. And these were split-up parents, weren't they?
Yeah, although certainly a lot of people came from split-up parents.
Right, that doesn't follow all the time.
Absolutely not.
But they're insecure enough that they can make even innocent words into threats in their own minds.
Yeah.
They feel like they need to deal with these threats in order to exert control.
Well, that would explain the motorbike shop,
right?
Situation.
Yeah, and did we read someplace that Charlie Carter laughed at him, or also?
Well, that's what on the 48 Hours episode, Kohlhepp's mother said that's why he killed him, because he was, I forget how she worded it, but he was back talking him and hurt him and upset him.
And upset him. Yeah. So take that.
Right. Yeah. That's when she made the comment about the bullying, that this is what happens when people bully, implying that Carver had bullied Kohlhepp and Kohlhepp had acted out.
Yes.
Violently. Yeah.
Wow.
Sure. So that's just taking it to a level that I don't find believable, but I can certainly see that someone with that psychology might interpret it that way.
Oh, definitely.
Not that it's correct.
No.
No.
But in their mind, that's how they interpret it.
Yeah. I think that's what she was saying in the Psychology Today article.
And I've also got some stuff from a criminal profiler named John Kelly.
Oh,
so
okay.
His idea is that Kohlhepp is hiding more bodies. He says that these guys always hold back some stuff. They all need to have their little secret.
Hmm.
Kohlhepp is a mass murderer who admitted to killing 4 people at one time, but he's also a sexual predator.
Right.
And my guess is, besides the 14-year-old that he raped in Arizona, that the woman who was married to the guy who were both killed.
What woman?
Coxie.
Oh, Megan Coxie?
Megan Coxie.
What about her?
Well, I'll bet she was kept alive for a time and was raped.
Well, see, that's something I thought about, yeah.
I will bet you that Kayla also, the reason she was kept alive was so that she could be raped.
Yeah. Well, in the interview with his mother, she said that, you know, he told her he didn't abuse Kayla, and that the reason he kept her alive is he didn't know what to do with her because she'd witnessed him killing her boyfriend. But I certainly don't believe that.
That's totally unbelievable.
I mean, thinking it through, I think that he killed the boyfriend so that he could rape her and keep her. And I think she was definitely going to be killed. I don't think he was ever going to let her go.
She wasn't going to be let go.
No.
That's for sure.
No.
She was going to be killed.
So I think it makes sense to think that something similar may have happened with the Coxies. That the man was killed right away and that she was tortured and abused.
I would bet money on it.
Yeah. But, you know, we'll find out more about that.
There's
still a lot to find out. But that would certainly make more sense to me. Although, like I said, this mother's in denial, and I think that she'll probably work through that a lot. She doesn't seem to be totally in denial. She seems to accept that he's done things wrong, and that she seems to accept it more than some people.
Well,
she's not quite in reality yet, but I think she's headed that way.
Yeah, she's kind of accepting it. I don't think she quite has grasped the magnitude.
Well, I mean, how could you?
Of what he's done.
Sure. But I think even in the parts of the interview that I saw, early in the interview, she was much more apologetic and feeling sorry for him and saying, I'm sad, and I think Todd is too.
Right.
But I think towards the end, she was kind of seeing that wasn't the case, that there was really something wrong with him. As she talked through his childhood and everything, she just could realize there's just something wrong with him.
I think she's looking at it that way.
Yeah.
But I still think she doesn't really grasp how twisted he is.
No. And I think it's tough. I mean, it's tough for her. My heart breaks for her as well as the families of the murdered people.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a horrible place to be in. I mean, the guilt she must feel.
Right.
It's just got to be horrible. So at 15 years old, Kohlhepp entered the adult prison system. And it was 2 months after entering that he was first cited for disobeying an order. It was the first of 7 violations that he would have, including violent behavior, which also included fighting, hitting a person, and destroying property. So he was about 30 when he was released, and he moved to South Carolina to be closer to his mother. And this is where we get to the point of, how did he get a real estate license? How did he get a pilot's license? How did he get guns? Which I know we've talked about, but that's just, to me, I don't get it. I don't see how you can become a realtor when you are, okay, maybe a felon can become a realtor because you've done your time, but you're a registered sex offender. How are you a realtor? How do they expect that you're going to do that and not run into children? That's not realistic to me.
That's a good question.
But, I mean, he must have had a probation officer when he got out.
You're preaching to the choir here.
Well, sure, but I don't get it.
I don't either.
Okay.
I mean, you're right. He's paid his debt to society, but at the same time, he's a registered sex offender.
Yeah, and that never goes away.
And that doesn't change.
Right.
And he's going to be exposed to families.
Right.
When he's working as a realtor. So I just don't know.
Yeah.
But.
So obviously the guns were gotten illegally. That wasn't something that he was allowed to do.
No.
No.
Well, they could be legally obtained in the sense that he went to a gun show and did a private purchase.
Yeah. Yeah, but I don't think that's legal. He might have done it under the radar, but if the police had come to his home and he had guns, or if he was pulled over and he had a gun in his car,
he'd be cooked.
It was illegal for him to be in possession of a gun.
Certainly.
Regardless of how he got it.
But the interesting thing would be that he could have legally purchased it at a gun show.
Would it be legal, though? I don't think so.
Sure. It's a private sale.
Yeah, but don't you think you have to sign something that says you're not a felon there, even though they don't do a check?
No.
No?
No.
Why do you think that?
You just go up and buy it.
Huh.
Remember the recent election, they were in Maine was trying to change the law.
I'm aware of that. Yeah, I understand.
And it got voted down.
I understand that it's a loophole.
Right.
But I still think that he having the gun at all was a crime. So whether the purchase, maybe the purchase was legal, but the fact that he had it was illegal.
Okay.
So it wasn't really legal.
I'll agree with that.
Okay. So what did John Kelly, the expert, have to say?
Well, besides that he was a serial killer, mass murderer, and a sexual predator.
Yeah.
He said the only other serial killer who comes close to Kohlhepp is the guy known as the BTK killer.
Huh.
So this is a guy named Dennis Rader, who in 1974 entered a Kansas home and murdered four people. And then in subsequent years, before his 2005 arrest, he focused on women driven by his sexual desires. And Kelly says, Kohlhepp is in the same class. He lived for the stimulation of the hunt, finding, controlling, and dominating women.
Okay.
That's him.
Right. So is he the one that thinks that there are probably more people he's killed?
Yeah, I already said that.
Okay. I'm just trying to keep him straight because there were quite a few experts.
I know. We had a bunch.
Yeah.
But yeah, he says he thinks there's more because he's always got to hold an ace in his hand.
Yeah.
And he's got more people.
Well, plus, you know, that is a long break between 2003 and 2000. That's like a 12-year break where he didn't kill anyone. That's kind of hard to swallow.
Allegedly.
Allegedly, yes.
But
right.
I would bet money that there's going to be more bodies.
Yeah. Well, I hope not.
Maybe not on his property. Although it's 100 acres, there's plenty of places to bury people there.
Sure. Yeah.
And just the logistics, I don't see how they can search the whole area.
Okay, well, we'll find out more as time goes on.
Yeah, fascinating case.
I think
case.
That's all I know for now.
It's just an amazing case.
It is, wow.
I mean, I remember on the news they talked about, this woman who had been held captive for a couple months was found and rescued. And you're thinking, how great is that? And then, like, immediately, and by the way, he's confessed to killing seven people.
Well, I don't know if that was immediate, but yeah.
Pretty quickly.
Pretty quickly, yeah.
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 You know, it's like he wanted to unburden himself, and he said, yeah, there's these three bodies here, and I also did that bike shop murder.
Is it unburdening? I don't know. Is it bragging? I don't know.
Yeah. Could be.
Right? Or is it just, well, I'm going to go to prison anyway. I might as well tell him more. I don't know how that works. That'd be an interesting thing to look into, how that works. Because he didn't really seem to feel regret, although the policeman who was with him after he confessed said that he did show regret. He was praying with them and showing regret, but I don't know how genuine you could think that is.
Not.
You don't think it's genuine?
No.
Okay. All right, Dickie, why don't you tell people about your contest again? Let people know how that's going.
Okay. Let me find some stuff here.
Okay.
Because I got to read this stuff because I can never remember.
Okay.
I can remember some of it. All right, folks. You ready?
Ready.
Okay. This is the contest to win a True Crime Brewery t-shirt. It's running from November 1st to January 1st. So I want you to give me a beer review. The only stipulation, pretty much the only stipulation, is that this is a spoken review. So you can do the voicemail link on tygrabber.com or an audio file on your computer or smartphone and attach to an email at truecrimebrewery@tygrabber.com. So get those entries in.
Yeah.
We're looking at a few already. Need some more. I want to have a really close contest here.
Yeah. What criteria are you judging on? Just let people know that again.
Oh, geez. Okay. So I just basically, I want a good review of a good beer. That's it.
Okay.
Okay. I don't want people reviewing Budweiser or Miller or Coors. I want...
Unless they did it in a really entertaining way, then I'd enjoy listening to it.
But yeah,
I know,
maybe.
You don't want that.
I don't want those.
Okay.
I want a nice original beer review.
Okay. And we're not judging audio quality, so do it however you can. Doesn't matter.
You can do it in a wind tunnel if you want.
But we want you to be creative and detailed.
As detailed as
you would be. You're pretty detailed.
I'm not really.
Well,
I'm pretty succinct.
Yeah.
You should read some of the reviews I see.
Really?
Yeah.
Longer? I mean, how much can you write about a beer?
A lot.
Really? Okay. All right.
If mine is a haiku, this is maybe a bad metaphor or simile or something, but if my beer review is a haiku, other people write a novel.
Oh, maybe a sonnet.
More than a sonnet.
Really?
A novella. How's that?
Novella. Okay. Short story. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, some people, I think, obviously, the people that can write well do longer reviews.
Sure.
And they're certainly more prose-filled.
Yeah, but there's something to be said for quality above quantity, I believe.
Well, that's my theory anyway.
Okay.
But
okay,
anyway,
so let's get those entries in.
Bring me some entries. I'm looking for some more.
Okay. So also, you didn't mention that there's a coaster too, a shirt and a coaster.
I forgot the coaster
because
that was an add-on.
That's an add-on.
By somebody.
Yep. Okay. So thanks for listening. True Crime Brewery is available on Stitcher, on Google Play, iTunes, and also now on iHeartRadio. And it's also available on our website, www.tygrabber.com. Look for us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, and make sure you do our shopping through our Amazon link, tygrabber.com/Amazon. Or you can just go to our website and click on Shop Amazon and support Tygrabber and go do your shopping. For hardcore listeners, we have Team Tygrabber, where you can commit to $2 a month or more, and you can support independent podcasting. Also, we have a Patreon account, which I recently updated, so you could check that out, and you could support us on Patreon, and there you can also find the episodes to listen to. So we will see you next week. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, folks. This was a fun case. We'll talk to you next time.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.